Okay, greetings. Good afternoon to everyone joining from Australia and Asia, and morning to everyone from Europe. And welcome to this Goldman Sachs Commodity Trading Update on metals, thermal coal, and uranium. We're joined today by Adam Gillard in London, who heads up the GS Metals sales desk. Adam will cover off on trading views on aluminium and copper. We're also joined.
请关注公众号思维纪要社，更多纪要请加V.CN20210130。
By Thomas Schwegler, also based in London, who's a senior trader in gas, coal, and uranium. And Thomas will provide views on thermal coal and uranium. And I'm also joined by my research colleague in the UK, Matt Green. Before we commence, I'll cover GS compliance requirements. This call is strictly for clients of Goldman Sachs only. This conversation is not intended for the media and is off the record. And this call is not for the purpose of sharing or receiving non-public or otherwise confidential information. Attendees are public, so our market participants who may not receive and should not request non-public or otherwise confidential information about issuers or securities or about the markets for securities. So the agenda for today's call will be a 20 to 30 minute discussion with Adam and Thomas. We'll have some time for Q&A. We'll try and keep this call to 30 minutes. And if you'd like to ask a question, you can raise your hand or you can alternatively email myself direct or Matt Green direct to send us questions. All right, let's get started. So Adam and Thomas, thanks for joining from London. Obviously, a lot going on in commodity markets. I think we'll firstly start on with you, Adam, on aluminium and copper, and then we'll finish with Thomas on thermal coal and uranium. Adam, let's start with aluminium, and let's start with what is the trading desk's latest assessment of the scale and duration of the aluminium supply disruptions in the Middle East?
Sure. Thanks, Paul, for having me. So our base case is that the EGA disruption lasts until the end of the year, which is 1.2 million tonnes lost. Albert operate at 50% for Q2 and Q3, and then at 70% during Q4, which is roughly 520,000 tonnes. Qatalum is 170,000 tonne loss until the end of the year, with Arauco at 65K, although clearly a bit of a margin of error on that one. So that's roughly 2 million tonnes of aluminium that's gone, split 70% alloys, so billet and slab, and 25% ingot. So Alba is where the uncertainty lies. Lines 1 to 3, which we know are off, is 300,000 tonnes, or 20% of full-year production. Woodmac a few weeks back implied they're at 30% capacity, which in theory is 1.1 lost. We don't really have any visibility around that. Channel checks with trade houses and physical traders seem to suggest potline 4's gone, but it's all quite unclear at the moment. So out of the uncertainty in our balance, we think on the desk, 2 million tonnes gone for this year.
That's great, Adam. From a trading perspective, can you talk through both the desk and the franchise's positioning?
Yep. So on the desk, we're running long flat price positions on the curve, both second half 26 and first half 27. I would say that our long is about a 6 or 7 out of 10 in terms of our max position that we'd usually run. We were longer. We have cut into the rally. In terms of franchise positioning, I think we should split that between China and ex-China macros. So in terms of ex-China macros, I don't think it's an exaggeration to say that almost everyone we speak to are long, because most have the same roughly 600,000 ton quarterly deficits we do, which in part I think explains why aluminium isn't pricing the expected inventory draw, because the market's long and on any rally, the franchise sells into that strength. So in terms of China, outside of a flurry of activity last week on some unverified talk that the EU was going to change the Russian import cap, the Chinese haven't really been involved, probably because domestic inventory from a pure ingot perspective is still that we can see about 1.5 million tonnes, which is up almost 100% year on year, whilst frankly demand is down 4%, which is the equivalent of 150,000 tonnes a month of additional supply you're getting through lost demand. So I think that's why China hasn't engaged so far. And our view is that it's very difficult for any industrial metal to rally without China, so that for aluminium to hit the next leg higher, we very much do need China.
And then maybe, Adam, turning to value-add products and premiums. I mean, Middle East smelters produce a lot of value-add products. So we've seen a big spike in regional and downstream premiums. How do you view those current pricing dynamics, and is it plausible for all-in billet prices to approach the levels we last saw in 2022?
Sure. So I think the answer to that question depends on the speed of Chinese exports, which will be in part impacted by domestic demand. So at $1,000 premium for Italian, German, like delivery duty paid billet, we think that the Chinese alloy arb is open. That's subject to, which is subject to 15% tax. We think that's open by around $200 a ton, assuming an onshore billet premium of about 150. But that's assuming no anti-dumping tariffs, which would suggest the metal has to be rerouted through Asia. So right now, obviously, you know, you can see elevated billet premiums in Europe. That should start to be met by Chinese exports. So the extent to which European premiums rally really comes down to what Chinese demand is. So said another way, if Chinese billet demand starts to improve and then they then compete for the metal, then the ex-China premium will have to rise even further to incentivize those exports to meet the deficit. So we do expect upside from current levels once Europe finishes destocking, because there is still some legacy stuff coming out from EGA. But we don't have a strong view, to be candid, about whether or not we make the all-time highs given current Chinese demand headwinds.
Thanks, Adam. So I guess moving forward, there's a lot of concern out there about demand destruction at current prices. In your view, is demand more likely to be curtailed by price levels or by physical tightness in availability?
So GIR think that a 1% slowdown in global GDP impacts aluminium demand by about 1.9%, which is 1.4 million tonnes, or 70% of our full year 26 supply loss. So on the desk, like rightly or wrongly, outside of temporary sort of price related destocking, like we've seen in China currently or in copper in 2024, we think that it's the availability of units that will be the primary driver of demand destruction in the medium term, which essentially is why we're still bullish, because the metal is available. It's just in China, and the LME price needs to rise to incentivize those exports.
Okay, Adam, rounding off the discussion on aluminium, you mentioned the desk are running along. What do you see as the catalyst for a 10% move higher in aluminium?
Yeah, so our view is that the LME price will struggle to price the deficit until China gets involved, which we don't think happens until the West bids for and ultimately takes domestic inventory. So said another way, like the only solver of, in our view, of the ex-China deficit outside of demand destruction is Chinese metal. So then it's a question of, okay, well, what are the stages for domestic inventory to draw? So we think the path is, broadly speaking, as follows. One, Europe just continues to destock, which is what's happening now. We know there's always more in the supply chain in the woodwork than you think. And then once that destocking ends, which we expect in about a month, that should cause metal that's currently in Asia priced against MJP to be redirected into Europe. There's no real shortage there. That market's relatively soft. We think physical is trading at about $100 below the index. And then the third step, you know, in our view, is that Rusal metal is diverted away from China towards MJP in Europe. So we think that about 90,000 tons a month of Russian exports to China are contracted versus their domestic alumina toll, where they get the VAT savings, with the balance 100,000 tons per month, like able for redirection. And the next step in our view would be higher semis exports, which we think is happening now because clearly there's no export tax on Chinese semis exports, followed by billet slab exports, which are subject to a 15% tax, and lastly, if we have to get there, ingot exports at a 30% tax. So steps like 3 through 6, so from Russian exports through to ingot exports, should result in lower Chinese inventory, which we think the Chinese specs will react to, and you saw a bit of a preview of that last week when they bid it quite aggressively on expectations that wrongly in our view, but their expectations that the EU would change their Russian import assumption. So all in, how to wrap it up. We don't think that the LME price can rally without China. We don't think China gets involved until the West bids and takes their metal. And that's the process by which we think they don't.
That's great, Adam. Well, look, thanks for that. Let's move on to copper. Are you surprised by the resilience in copper prices? And what do you see as the key drivers supporting the market at current levels?
Yeah, it's traded well, better than we thought. We think the strength was the price strength was due to two factors. One, strong Chinese demand. We had March apparent demand up about 7 to 8%. We think April is probably going to be plus 6%, assuming the same net sequential trade data. I think in part due to downstream restocking, so the preliminary numbers we have on rod, plate, production was up sort of 10 to 15%. So, yeah, very strong Chinese demand. Secondly, US imports remained strong, just shy of 200,000 tons a month during Q1 versus pre-tariff flows of around 75,000 tons a month. All whilst macro length was on the lows, cut into the war on the rates move, and then broader risk rally, dollar sold off on the Iran de-escalation. So, yeah, I think drivers were a surprising bid from China, frankly, a surprising bid from the US against legacy COMEX R contracts, with positioning low and border risk doing well.
And Adam, how are investors positioned at a higher level? So how's the market position in copper today, and what indicators or signals are you watching to assess the next move?
I think position is still relatively low. On the desk, we are long, but we're running sort of 2-3 out of 10, essentially just buying dips because, for better or worse, we believe in the de-escalation. We don't think there's been significant Chinese or macro re-engagement, though. So that's part of the reason why we're comfortable having this cautious long. In terms of signals to watch, frankly, I think it's as simplistic as one, the CHEF LME import arb and trade flows, which will be in part driven by domestic inventory. You can't be short copper with Chinese demand greater than 5%, which is what it is currently. So I think that's going to be key. Two, whether or not US imports pick up in May, June as the tariff play comes back ahead of an expected announcement in June and July. Three, any issues around DRC, SXEW production in Q3. So the view on the desk really is that we're back to the 2025 regional deficit trade. We might be in a 500,000-ton global surplus, but if both the US and China continue to compete for metal, then your LME balance moves into deficit and your surplus ultimately just sits in the US, which is frankly financed by Wall Street, and as it's hard for the metal to come out, we think it means the LME price can perform.
That's great. Just wrapping up copper here, you've touched on a lot of key points there, but just what are the themes currently dominating conversations with clients just around copper, and have those discussions shifted meaningfully in recent weeks?
Yeah, sure. So I would say five themes that discussion points that are coming up in conversation. One, how long will this Chinese demand pull last for? Our view is it's probably decelerating. We're not going to get 7% demand growth for the next 2 to 3 months, which is why we're looking at the sort of Sheffield arb as an indicator so much. Two, will Trump announce a 15% tariff implemented in Jan 27 in late June? Three, if a tariff is announced, will the market partly price a 30% tariff due to be implemented in Jan 28. For if that tariff playbook does happen, what does that mean for regional deficits and then LME spreads? And then lastly, does the sulfur squeeze actually matter? So where we come out on all this is goes back to this regional deficit trade. If China pulls, if trade houses do what we think they're doing, which is the feedback from Cesco Santiago, and continues to max long-term contracts into the US, and that sort of flex LATAM tons become back in play, then the LME is going to get tight. And it's regional deficits matter, and we're trading an LME contract.
Thanks, Adam. I've got a few questions coming through on metals, but we're gonna pause on those and switch to Thomas on energy and coal and uranium specifically. So Thomas, thanks for joining, and it's gonna be great to chat through coal and uranium, which are, you know, have had a lot of focus and there's been a lot of movement there. So maybe starting with thermal coal, what have you observed in the thermal coal market since the conflict began, and have there been any material shifts in fundamentals, flows, or sentiment as a result?
Yeah, look, I think it's important to note that, you know, before the crisis began, there was definitely a very strong bearish rhetoric across the European energy markets, you know, off the back of, you know, abundance of supply coming to the market and, you know, relatively high stocks on a global basis, you know, whether you're looking at gas or in particular coal, and coal for that matter.
请关注公众号,思维纪要社,更多纪要请加V,CN20210130.
You had, you know, certainly a much higher kind of oversupply shape, especially in China, where they're just facing significant increase of, you know, renewable capacity, and that's, you know, causing more and more sort of thermal displacement and putting more sort of, you know, curtailment on demand. And actually, that's why, you know, a lot of the rhetoric around the potential, you know, well, at the time, certainly the potential Indonesian cuts, you know, weren't having a particularly material impact on the market, because it's really what the market needed was to have some of that excess supply coming out of the market. You know, we already saw the likes of Glencore, you know, announcing some cuts out of Colombia. So, you know, the market was clearly going into this year with quite a heavy, you know, supply situation. So, you know, a lot of the initial move was, kind of, you know, reversing out of those short positions. You know, both, 8x2 and Newcastle had, I think it was about $33 sort of move from pre-crisis to the top. We've now pretty much retraced, you know, all of that and are virtually at, you know, pre-crisis levels again. You know, I would say, you know, outside of that, I mean, fundamentals obviously haven't changed. It has been sort of direct, you know, supply disruption. There's no coal that's impacted through the straits. You know, we have seen, I guess, utilities, especially in Europe, take advantage of more favorable dark spread economics. And a lot of that has been also led by the fact that your European emissions prices have come down significantly, which has been more to do with the European Commission trying to drive down you know, that price. A lot of governments actually, you know, voicing their concerns that it's getting overbought to the top side and having a detrimental effect on power prices across Europe. So we've seen emission prices come down a lot, and, you know, with gas prices much higher on a relative basis, that's made coal actually relatively cheaper in the context of the power stack, and making darks more attractive. So we have seen that utility hedging come in, you know, especially as we look out to winter next year.
Thomas, that's great. Look, if we were to see the conflict persist here, do you see scope for just a switching up in the dynamics on coal switching? And what triggers do you think could drive further upside in the Newcastle 5.5 and 6K price?
Yeah, I mean, it's, you know, it's tricky now for Europe, because obviously entering, you know, shoulder season, and kind of, you know, relatively heavy maintenance season. So, you know, demand levels, you know, are still gonna move down. You know, some of the bigger, I guess, coal demand spots in the wider Europe, you know, Turkey's one of them. They've had a very, very high, you know, hydro balance, that's, you know, curtailed their coal demands, and generally kind of entering into a higher renewable period across Europe. So, you know, despite coal being ahead of the stack in Europe, you know, demand is still going to stay at relatively low levels as we go through this, you know, this sort of Q2 period. You know, on the Asia side, you know, most plants were really running base load anyway, as a relative cheapness to, you know, to gas burn. You know, certainly the more impacted countries with the likes of Philippines, you know, Vietnam, who are much more reliable on hand-to-mouth coal imports, you know, versus the likes of China or India, who have a much bigger, you know, wider operation that they can optimize accordingly, you know, different provinces, transmission lines, et cetera. So, you know, I think it's really a question of, the length of this staying an issue, and you know, eventually does that really have to bring in, you know, additional price support to coal, you know, finally increase demand for coal as gas just becomes, you know, eventually not replaceable at too high prices. I would say, sorry, I mean, the, you know, we have seen some, you know, regulatory changes, I guess, which has been, you know, positive for coal. You know, Korea was really one of the main ones to kind of relax their sulfur restrictions. So we've definitely seen a bit more of an uptick of both still Russian, but also Australian products. You know, Japan have also announced some changes to their scope, but actually it's had, you know, a relatively small amount of difference in terms of demand expectations. So, you know, Korea has certainly been the first one, you know, and so that definitely represents scope for higher demand going forward.
Yeah, thanks, Thomas. Back on the supply side, and you've sort of touched this a little bit, but with Indonesia expected to introduce export quotas, and there's some debate about that, and Colombian volumes already reduced, which supply risks or dislocations are you monitoring most closely? Is it Indonesia?
Yeah, I mean, that's obviously the big question mark, and it's always a big question mark. I mean, they, you know, they're very well known for, you know, having a guidance and, you know, overstepping it, you know, by quite some margin. So they've come with a pretty drastic curtailment. I think last year was around 740 million tons. They're now targeting 580, so pretty drastic change. Now, you know, they've always been pretty sort of, you know, elastic to Chinese demand. So in the case, I would expect that suddenly there's a huge surge in prices, that there certainly should be the ability to turn on the taps a bit more and provide a bit more, supply into the region. You know, I think they're certainly facing issues with, you know, meeting their domestic market obligations, which is obviously, you know, front and foremost for the country. You know, I'm sure we all remember when Indonesia banned exports for a month because so many, you know, producers didn't meet their DMO obligations. And certainly their domestic demand requirements are increasing, you know, every year that we go by. So that pot is growing, you know, their cash costs are growing as a result. So there's definitely more pressure there. And actually, you know, on the cash cost front, you know, the whole sort of, you know, diesel impact is really the front and center. And Matt actually, you know, brought this up to me yesterday and reminded me, you know, obviously, you know, in Australia is obviously facing one of the biggest acute shortages, you know, in the globe. And actually diesel accounts for, 40% of, you know, mining operations, in Australia, of which, you know, almost half of that is for coal. So, you know, that can have a significant impact on your cash costs. And if prices remain, you know, too subdued for too long, you know, that could force further curtailments, on the producer side. So that's certainly an item to keep an eye on.
So Thomas, you've mentioned that in your opening remarks how Nuke has given up a lot of its gains since the conflict began. How do you see? Do you have a strong view of where you see pricing evolving from here, and what factors are you sort of do you think will be critical to shaping the near term outlook on pricing here? You touched on diesel. Is this more supply, or do you think demand is an area you're keeping a close eye on as well?
Yeah, I mean that's the big question mark as we try and think about, you know, this the whole from a whole energy European energy perspective, and coal on a global basis. You know, the longer this goes on, you know, it's almost binary. If we think that, you know, ships can start, you know, or Qatar can resume by sort of, you know, end June, July, then, you know, the market could be okay and resolve, and restocking can sort of happen, or by slightly higher prices than where they were. If this continues for much longer, then we could face a pretty acute situation, you know, very quickly. So, you know, timing is certainly everything in this scenario. You know, the diesel implication I mentioned, you know, that's obviously, the longer that goes on, the bigger implications, you know, that has. You know, and then we move on to, you know, what does real summer demand, you know, look like? And there's been a lot more talk about, you know, potential, you know, much higher temperatures, especially through Asia, through El Nino. If that materializes, we generally see much more, you know, higher requirements due to cooling demand. We've started to see, stocks draw a little bit in China. So, any substantial, restock requirements, especially for the likes of China, or India as we lead into summer and certainly throughout summer, that's certainly the key metric to keep an eye on, as long as there's enough supply to, to meet those expectations.
Yeah, thanks, Thomas. Let's move to uranium and finish there before we actually just address some of the questions coming through from the investors. What are your latest views on the uranium market? Any views you can share on price outlook in the near term on the spot and term market, and any views on inventory positioning and what you're seeing on the trading side?
Yeah, look, I think we've gone through recently with multiple sort of earning releases, earning calls, news outlets of major like production guidance, notifications, updates on, for example, the Kazakh sulfuric acids, all of those items have somewhat stabilized. We've gone through a few like regulatory hurdles on some of the big next assets coming online again. And so we're really kind of in a, I almost call it back to sort of, real sort of fundamental driver with no sort of, major announcement expected on the way. And what's really missing in the market is just that kind of replacement rates of demand from the utilities. They've been a lot quieter, a lot slower in filling out their term requirements. We know certainly that they're relatively well covered, through the end of this decade, and it's really kind of in the early 2030s where there's a lot of uncovered demand, and that's coincidentally where we see that much larger structural deficit really appear in the as part of the supply demand dynamics. It's important to know that actually due to the fuel cycle length of time in uranium of about 2 years from like securing your mined U3O8 up until you get actual full fuel assembly to put into your power plant, that's a long lead time. So utilities tend to have a huge amount of buffer in their fuel cycle chain, and hence why there's no sort of immediate scrambling for spare material very last minute like you might have in coal or gas, where you can really feed hand to mouth perspective. So there's always that buffer in the uranium fuel chain, which means you don't have these substantial price movements. And of course, through this whole Iran situation, everything's been very stable, hasn't really affected the uranium markets. There were a few concerns about the availability of sulfuric acids due to the amount of sulfur that passes through the straits, but a lot of the larger players have and are increasing their own domestic capacity, and so for now we haven't seen any signs of that becoming a significant impact. Inventory still maintains a buffer, and every time we have a little bit of a price moving upwards, we obviously have a bit of reselling. It could be reselling commercial inventory. It could be, reversing out of repos in the market, out of carry trades, that to release more supply into the spot market. So there's always that little bit of incremental supply at slightly higher prices. But what the market really needs is to see is that increase of replacement rate contracting from end user demand. Obviously got to mention, Sprott has been, taking up a lot of pounds over the last 6 months. They had a big wave of ad hoc investor interest in November last year, I think it was. And then again, pretty substantial buying appetite in February as they renewed their prospectus. So they remain sort of at the forefront of the spot markets in terms of soaking up pounds. They are close already to 6 million pounds purchased so far this year, and we are remiss not to remind everyone that they have a 9 million cap on a yearly basis on their prospectus. So they've done a lot of that already. They may be able to have more of this ad hoc requirements on top of that, but it's certainly worth noting, how much they've done already so far this year.
Thanks, Thomas. Look, we're coming up on time, but we have a couple of questions in. Adam, if I can maybe just circle back to aluminium. We've got a question here saying, for the over 2 million tons of, annualized supply that's out of the market in the second half of this year, realistically, how much do you think can come back online in the next 3 to 6 months?
Sure. So within 3 to 6 months, I think the way you would stress it is you would assume that Alba is just a 30% loss. So that would bring 200,000 back versus our estimate, and then maybe another 50 from Cuffelam. If you look further forward into Q4, EGA said that they would be out for, max 12 months. So you could argue that we have a 400,000 loss in Q4 from EGA, half that, that's another 200,000 back, which essentially takes your Cal 26 loss from EGA, Alba, Cuffelam, and Arauco from 2 million tons to 1.5. So I think that the flex is twofold. One, it is EGA coming back earlier than the market expects or than we expect, and two, lower disruptions at Alba than Wood Mackenzie implied.
Okay, that's great. We're going to wrap the call up there, everyone. If you didn't get to ask a question or you have any follow-ups for Adam or Thomas, you can email myself or Matt. Adam and Thomas, thanks for all the insights today. Appreciate your time, and thanks to all the investors for joining this call. Enjoy the rest of your day and chat again soon.